Phil and Sequoia, can't forget Sequoia. Welcome to the Global Movement Summit. Oh, it is delicious as ever and amazing as ever to bring you into the space and bring you into this conversation. And I can never forget tracing how we found each other or how I found your work on the internet and how profound it's been ever since then. So I'm just so honored to be opening this door and kind of going to the rest of the world, dropping on our conversation.
Beautiful.
So thank you so much for making the time this morning to connect. I was just kind of going over something on your website, and I mean, there's just so many of them and there's just so much rich content, but something that really just jumped up that I kind of wanted to start with was this idea of unimagined scopes of wealth. That, you know, we're talking about sustainability, or predominantly the world out there is talking a lot about sustainability and all these kind of movements, and it's all great and it's all trending and it's all green and just put green on it and it's going to be okay. But it's not. You know, we're moving into a world of thrivation. And I love this quote that you've put on the side, and I just wanted to pull that up and see what unravels as this, with this being the starting point. But you talk about the physical, emotional, intellectual, and spiritual well-being. And you look at that, they're all life-based and not machine-based realities. They are both, and rather than either or phenomena. The idea that true wealth multiplies itself, that there is no upper limit to it, and that as a species, if we finally get to connect to all of it and see the interconnectedness, we get to move into a new world and a new way of operating in that space. And it just, like, one little minuscule door opening way of kind of going, what's really possible? I mean, we're sitting on like so many different changes and it could go any way. So what do you see being really possible, and where do you see wealth fitting into all of that?
It's a lovely place to start. Our culture, our pervasive worldview in almost all of our societies tends to be problem-solving oriented. We have created social architecture. We have designed our traditional organizations are really designed to control people and to control nature. And they tend to have fairly narrow and myopic goals. And they're designed more as machines. They're not designed like the rest of nature is designed. That's continually unfolding itself toward ever-increasing beauty and ever-increasing intricacy and ever-increasing consciousness, ever-increasing interdependence and collaboration. That's happening everywhere, but we began designing organizations some 5,000 years ago. That's about the time of the pyramids, and coincidentally, our organizations, all traditional organizations, almost without exception, tend to be kind of pyramid-shaped. So that's the pyramid paradigm. It sort of gives us social forms, human systems that tend to be kind of mechanical. They tend to separate people from each other and treat people as separate things. They tend to encourage conforming to order as defined by the system. And so what we have in all of our traditional systems, and I would love to be contradicted on this with good evidence to the contrary, but there are some innovative things happening in the world, especially outside of our traditional systems. But the bulk of our world, the bulk of our societies, basically are being shaped by these traditional systems, which are kind of have this mechanistic pyramid-shaped paradigm. Mm-hmm. all of nature is more than magical. You know, it's divine. It's a part of I believe, I choose to believe, that we are all part of divinity, and that we are all connected, and that we're all in this boat together, and that we can make the choice to learn to evolve as the rest of nature is evolving toward beauty, toward caring, toward ever increasing true wealth, to go back to your original question. Mm-hmm. But the nature of the psychic prisons that we're in, and that permeates our thinking, it permeates our media, permeates everywhere, is not to see who we really are. And then the nature of the design of these systems, the pervasive flawed design, is that it creates lots of problems. And the more of these traditional systems that you have controlling more and more your life, the more problems you have. And so our focus on problems tends to be self-fulfilling. Whatever you pay attention to tends to become your God. So there's a huge gap between what we think is possible, realistically given our world today, and what's really possible. So we have no trouble visualizing how bad things could get. Because in certain parts of the planet, they're getting that, they are that bad, and they have been that bad. And that's a natural consequence of systems that basically keep people unconscious and are based on control over people and nature. Mm. So what's possible? What's possible? I am absolutely convinced that we have the different forms of wealth on this planet, the material wealth, the intellectual wealth, the social wealth, the social capital, the cultural capital, the spiritual capital, the experiential capital, the living capital, even the financial capital. There's more than enough to do whatever we choose to do as a people if we were to actually be able to get together to do that, if we had our systems designed to for life rather than for lesser objectives. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I am convinced it's possible for everyone not just to be employed, because so much employment is kind of a very limiting goal when you consider that over 2/3 of the people who are employed are really not engaged in their work. They're really not turned on, much less getting close to being fulfilled. So only a tiny fraction of the people on our planet are engaged in fulfilling work. And almost all of them are not in systems. They've found a way to, because the systems aren't really designed to maximize the number of people who are engaged in fulfilling work. We've reached a point where transformation in the business realm frequently is seen as downsizing, which is kind of the opposite. Minimizing jobs, reducing headcount. So it seems like our systems, that all of life would improve very dramatically if our systems were designed to create fulfilling work. And it's not like there isn't work to be done.
More than enough.
We have, if you look at the 7 billion people we have on the planet, how many of, what would the planet be like if these people were supported in moving toward their full potential? Most of the crises, a lot of the crises on our planet are a result of the inequities, the result of the limitations and the constraints and the poverty and the starvation and the pain and the suffering, etc. And that's all unnecessary. Nature doesn't design itself that way. We don't need to. Let me stop here and see if I'm going where you want me to go and where you want to go from here.
Too many deliciousness things. One of the earlier seeds that you brought up was this, again, the machine kind of culture that we've just kind of been impregnated into that, and we're just kind of going on, blinkers on, into that system. And reminded, first of all, that we're human, which seems to be a lot of the conversations that seem to be coming up at the moment. I don't know if you're having this in your sphere, but certainly in a lot of the spheres that I kind of connecting to, it's like, we need to remember we're actually human, and what does that mean for us? And how do we have a full embodied experience of that? And then to remember that we are actually nature, which is, I think, where the point of actualization, or like the point of greatest leverage thing, because it's like, we're actually part of this ecosystem. We keep putting ourselves outside of it. We're still trying to put ourselves on top of it with that pyramid. We're still trying to find a box, think outside the box, redesign the box, whatever that may be, in all these kinds of spaces, and make that our job, rather than what I heard you really saying, like the real job is to even go beyond like Maslow's hierarchy of needs. I mean, I recently came across and did a conversation with the Barrett, who did the Barrett needs, and you know, it looks at cohesion and social transformation and being of service and being of, like, fully nourished. And these are pieces that we've never allowed ourselves to go to, but these are the pieces that actually get to alchemize change in organizations and personally as well.
So let me make sure that I'm with you there. Are you referring to Richard Barrett's Value Center?
Yes.
His work, I think, is just extraordinary. He's clearly an evolutionary architect. And he has created this instrument which can be applied at the organizational level, at the city level, at the country level. He's done it with a number of countries. And what's powerful is most surveys tend to focus on kind of it's a satisfaction survey, and you tend to focus on the lower levels of Maslow's hierarchy. He has gone beyond just Maslow's hierarchy, because he includes the service to the larger whole as a part of it. But the instrument permits organizations to survey the people involved to see what their profile is. And then that lets them begin to have a language around what's important around here. And so they can begin to address that. And so his work is one of the major building blocks in supporting our existing systems in making that metamorphosis from the caterpillar-like state, where the focus is on consumption and growth, to the butterfly state, where the focus is on adding beauty, touching the earth lightly, collaborating across boundaries, procreating, traveling. So thank you for bringing him in. Richard Barrett's a great social architect. And is, part of what I see to be needed in terms of the how of getting to the world that everyone wants. is to really see the existing traditional systems mm-hmm. as an incredible source of energy, of imagination, of power, of all the forms of capital, because they are in essence influencing how our many forms of capital are utilized. Mm-hmm. And so it's the evolutionary activist sees these traditional systems as important potential allies, and our challenge is how do we infect these systems with a new DNA, non-simplistic, mechanistic, pyramid-shaped DNA.
So I've actually got one of your quotes from an earlier conversation, which I absolutely loved, because we talked about finite and infinite games. And you talk about the answer is not in playing the game, it's in the DNA of what you want to create.
Yeah.
And it was just like, it's so profound. It's so radically obvious. Going back to a thread that you mentioned a little bit earlier as well, with this whole problem-solving culture. We have a problem and we go into work mode to solve it, and we just kind of get into that endless loop again. And the radical obvious thing is we don't have anything that's actually designing or thinking through the vision of what is that change that's going to be needed. We're just reactive and responsive and just in that culture of rather in that culture of maybe co, or that new prefix or suffix that's going to kind of change the way we build our new narratives.
Yeah, it's you're really doing a nice job of circling beginning to hem in what the problem is. So we our culture and our people are kind of entrapped in all of these overlapping systems, and the nature of the systems is that they don't really satisfy all of our needs, certainly don't begin to satisfy our possibilities. And problems are increasing, and the systems are not designed really to solve the problems. And so as these crises arrive, they get kicked to the top. So this ties up all the people who are supposed to be doing the thinking and creating the future in dealing with the messes that they have created and inherited. And so what we have are systems that are based upon literally very simplistic man-made DNA for organizing forms for human systems. Very simplistic. And if you look at the DNA, say, for humans, and you'd say, well, that's old fashioned. It was designed 3.5 billion years ago. But the design was pretty good, because all forms of life have been evolved using the same basic design. They just play with the variables in that design. And this DNA that happened to be invented in nature somehow by some stupid cells is just, you know, absolutely incredible. Like you have, I would say, looking at you, you have probably 40 trillion DNA cells. I probably have 55 trillion DNA cells in my body. And if you take just one of your DNA cells and you twirl that thing, it's 6 feet long. And if you put your DNA cells, if you stretch them out and you put them end to end, they'd go all the way to the moon.
Oh.
And back 4,000 times. So I don't know what was doing the thinking, but some thought went into our DNA. We humans have as our rite of passage the challenge of reinventing the DNA for our social forms. And what we're seeing is a lot of experimentation that's not very much is happening within traditional systems, mm-hmm. but some is happening in some sizable systems, and a lot is happening around the fringes. But what's needed is to recognize that our traditional systems can go through a metamorphosis. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be imposed from the outside. Like we can't grab a caterpillar and kind of force it to metamorphosize. It's something that manages to work out on its own. And anyway, what I've been...
Do we have all the ingredients then? I mean, is that part of the thing that's holding us back? Do we have we incubated all the things that we need to go into chrysalis mode?
Well, let's play. You want to play with that a little bit? Because
why not?
Well, what I like to do is, are you familiar with the imaginal cell story?
Please remind me.
Okay, it came from a book written by a being sort of like you. Her name is Nori Huddle, and this is from her book, and I've adapted it just a little bit, but I'd like to read it. It's the caterpillar's new cells are called imaginal cells. And they are so totally different from the caterpillar cells that his immune system thinks they are enemies and gobbles them up. But these new imaginal cells continue to appear, more and more of them. Pretty soon, the caterpillar's immune system cannot destroy them fast enough. More and more of the imaginal cells survive. And then an amazing thing happens. The tiny, little, lonely, imaginal cells start to clump and cluster into friendly little groups. They all resonate together at the same frequency. Mm. Like you and your friend. Passing information from one to another. Then after a while, another amazing thing happens. Mm-hmm. The clumps of imaginal cells start to cluster together. Mm-hmm. A long string of clumping and clustering imaginal cells, all resonating at the same frequency, all passing information from one to another there inside the chrysalis. Mm-hmm. And then at some point, the entire long string of imaginal cells suddenly realizes altogether that it is something different from the caterpillar. Something new, something quite wonderful. And in that realization is the shout of the birth of the butterfly. Mm. Since the butterfly now knows that it's a butterfly, the tiny little imaginal cells no longer have to do all the things that individual caterpillar cells must do. Now they are a multi-celled organism, a family that can share the work. Each new butterfly cell can take on a different job. There is something for everyone to do. Everyone is important. And each cell begins to do just that very thing it is most drawn to do. And every other cell encourages it to do just that. So that's a fanciful story that's pretty strongly based in actual biology. A famous innovative biologist, Elizabeth Sartoris, uses a somewhat less cavalier story, but she uses the same story, mm-hmm. The same essence. But I found this to be metamorphosis in general, and this particular story is the essence of the strategy that I think we need to adopt as a people. So what I am absolutely convinced of is that, and I'd be interested in your perception, But I would say that, let's call them imaginal souls.
Ah, yes.
That the number of imaginal souls in the world is growing very rapidly and exponentially. And they exist in every caterpillar. They exist in every system out there. They don't show up because they could get gobbled up. Are they afraid they will? Sure. And they don't connect with each other because there's no easy label, no easy way to identify each other, but they exist there. Mm-hmm. That number is growing. So there's evolution is wanting to happen. Mm-hmm. And it's our job to catch that wave and to find out how to work with it. Now, the key is, it's not going to happen just by individuals going through some sort of a transformational process. That's a kind of a necessary but not sufficient condition. Mm. What needs to happen is for the clumping and clustering to begin to happen. And that we need to develop the various kinds of chrysalis work that supports a system in making the shift from one that it's trapped in its own psychic prison to one that is supporting this kind of movement where no matter what its function is, whether it's transportation or governance, or education, or manufacturing widgets, that it has underneath that function the purpose of to the well-being of all life that system impacts. Mm-hmm. So this means that as a part of the crystals work, you're going to get not just a few people conscious, but you have to grow consciousness throughout the system. What I've been focusing on the last 10 years has been chrysalis work designed for systemic metamorphosis. Mm-hmm. And what I'm convinced is that the city is the appropriate unit of design that and the city includes all of the human systems that make up the city, not just the government offices, but everything. Businesses, transportation system, et cetera, et cetera. We have all of these, this cluster of human systems, all based upon the same pyramid DNA. But cities...
Can I ask a question?
Yes, you can.
What's immediately popping for me is there's such a movement now around smart cities and smart communities and designing it from this perspective. And I'm feeling, and I'm shifting, that this is a higher resonance than just pretty packaging and pretty boxing in terms of what the smart city movement is at the moment. So what's the gift, or what's the radical obvious thing that's these kind of architects of smart city design aren't seeing, and what's the gift that this can bring to them?
Okay, great question. And I've been trying to figure out how to answer it for the last 10 years. I have a clear vision of how it can unfold, at least begin. Explaining it so that it can be easily visualized by the rest of the world has been the challenge. So let me kind of circle it, and you can help me get clearer by asking me questions.
Perfect. But,
so if you look at metamorphosis for the caterpillar, the butterfly, what it does, it takes a system that it's a living system that it's early stage of development. And then it dedicates a pretty good chunk of its life in chrysalis before it moves into butterfly. Well, our system, our caterpillars are many-celled. They are very, very, very complex. and their complexity is exacerbated because they interact with each other. And so the key thing is to understand that we are not going to produce the chrysalis of a human system, limiting it to the kind of thinking that produced the systems that we now have. So we're not used to designing for metamorphosis. It's quite the opposite. We tend to design our systems to be more and more efficient at doing its recurring work, requiring less and less people. Which gives us another problem. Okay. But so the chrysalis work needs to happen over time. And so let me try to describe what this might happen, how this might unfold for a city. So the city that I'm currently kind of looking lustfully at is Oakland. I see the San Francisco Bay Area as being more gifted in terms, it has about 100 metropolitan municipal areas and a number of very, very sizable, very gifted, very challenged cities, and Oakland is one of them. But it has some very, very innovative people in it, and they have some real challenges that they need to deal with. So ideally here, we would identify people who have a passion for stewarding the future for Oakland. Ideally, this would include people who come from organizations that in effect are playing a large role in Oakland today. But it doesn't all need to come from there. It doesn't need to include the top leaders, but I'm imagining a cohort of maybe 24 game-ready infinite players, all of whom are deeply committed to mastering the art of supporting the metamorphosis of our human systems, are very turned on by the idea of moving Oakland from its current state to one which is more fulfilling for a larger part of its population and goes well beyond mere sustainability from a social, economic, and environmental standpoint. That's possible. As a matter of fact, we're more likely to get sustainable if we're targeting for something well beyond it than if we're settling or just getting us up to not being as broken and not destroying the earth as fast as we have been. It's not a very juicy goal.
No.
So we start with 24 people. These 24 people they see that if they can be a pioneer in making this happen, that is what they're here on this planet to do. Mm-hmm. So these people, some of them may be consultants, some of them may be educators, some of them may be officers within existing organizations in the city. But the idea is that the folks who are in traditional leadership roles are supporting the growing of this cohort. And this cohort is sort of the core of an ecosystem, what I would call a generative action learning ecosystem. Mm-hmm. So the purpose of this generative action learning ecosystem, GALE, GALE. So the purpose of this GALE ecosystem is to support the existing systems when they're ready and as they're ready in carrying out their metamorphosis. And each one is going to be unique. So this body does not have any governing authority.
That's really powerful, because normally things come around an intention or a goal and it has to have that end game. And this is just created for the purpose of
of
playing, of supporting, well, emerging.
Well, basically, what I'm convinced of is that it is possible for every traditional human system to, that is committed to multiplying its contribution to the well-being of life, to true wealth, which is where you started with this conversation. It's possible for every one of them to multiply their lasting contribution to the stakeholders they impact. And it has to do with freeing them from the constraints that they have mostly inherited, but are swimming in. Mm-hmm. And that,
can we just make that, can we just make the distinction between the lasting piece? Because people, a lot of people still think of triple bottom lines as being that filter system, and they're like, okay, great, got you, but it's not.
Well, I like a quintuple bottom line, which includes the triple, mm-hmm. but with a triple bottom line, as it exists in most organizations, tends to be people, planet, and profit. You know it.
Normally that one first.
So they look at, well, what can we do so that we are doing something in these other two areas? So they have the HR organization and they have their charities, etc. But I'm talking about here with a living system is where you consider the five stakeholder groups. I'm indebted to a brilliant woman named Carol Sanford for this particular definition of, or his, her five, her pentad on stakeholders. The first would be the customer population, who are impacted, contributed to, not just impacted, but who are the people who the organization is designed to serve with their products, services, etc. The second group would be co-creators, and that would include everybody on the supply chain and the distribution chain, whether they're inside the existing organization or not. The third would be Earth. Okay, as that no organization can exist without the contribution from the Earth, and we won't exist very long unless we are making a positive contribution back to the health of the Earth. The fourth is community. And this is not just contributing a little bit to existing traditional organization charities, but this is really looking at the community as a living system. How is this organization contributing to its transformation, to its metamorphosis? And finally, the investors. So the living system, a generative action learning living system, is evolving the organization. So it's increasing the consciousness throughout the organization as to how what they're doing is contributing to the now and the future well-being of all five of those stakeholder groups. So it goes beyond just a bottom line thinking. But just the bottom line sort of indicates that it's quantifiable and and constrained, narrow. The lines are skinny. So
it's like the space thing. It's like we've just reduced ourselves to that rather than, as you say, like looking at what's possible. And I'm just reminded of, you know, shoot for the moon, you'll always land in the stars anyway, kind of thing. But if we kind of go somewhere smaller than that, we create less than that.
Yes. So,
which is what you were saying with sustainability.
Yeah, I'm saying that we need to go beyond moonshots. Mm-hmm. That we've come back and the moon is still pretty much as it is, and we're pretty much as we are. So we're looking for a shot for the blue star, for we're really going for living up to what our potential is, what our purpose is as humans. And I choose to believe and am totally convinced that our purpose is to serve as co-creators, mm-hmm. as co-evolutionaries. And this is going to be a very large field. Right now, it doesn't exist anywhere, but it's one that we need to create. And the new educational institutions are going to be located in those systems.
Beautiful.
And the nature of higher education is going to be, how do you support those systems in learning to create the kind of crystals work that supports their moving beyond their caterpillar configurations? Mm-hmm. And it as I see it, the strategy for doing this is entirely needs to be commitment based.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to start at a city where the city is committed to go for it.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean everybody agrees to it, but they're agreeable to investing a small amount of their resources and some of their better talent in exploring who they want to be and how best to get there. And then the metamorphosis of individual systems is going to be, as they're ready to make that kind of commitment, that kind of investment. But the process is organic every mm-hmm. step of the way. Mm-hmm. And so you end up, it's going to take a while to grow people who can really see what it takes to grow organizations that are where all parts of the organizations are conscious
mm-hmm.
and caring, and where you have the various imaginal cells, you're supporting folks in finding what is their particular purpose and how do we best support that purpose. And maybe it's not in this system, but there are other systems.
Mm-hmm.
And what are creative ways that we multiply the difference we make for all of life? This doesn't mean you don't have money. This doesn't mean you don't, but it says we redefine economics. It's possible. Some cities are already doing that. So,
for sure. Because that's also the problem, is like you're wanting to create something new, but you've still got this thing that's behind you and that old structure that's informing it, and you plug into those old things and that's limiting. I was chatting to James, who is going to be on the summit as well, and we were talking about like how do we create these evolutionary or sustainable thriving practices. And it's like the minute you plug back into that old system or into that old economy, you're already limited because of that their mindset and that overpowering thing. So it's like, where do you find that space in that? Where do you bridge? Because otherwise you're either in or you're out, and you can't win an in as an out.
You're really looking to grow something within the system. So our organizations are designed to be mechanistic. And so it's not about somehow forcing life into there. It's about finding the system that's ready to support growing life within it.
Mm-hmm.
So what you need there are to take the people who are the innovators and the early adopters, who are trusted within the organization and trusted by the hierarchy. And their role is not to impose a new rule and to tear down existing structures, but to support the different parts of the traditional system in becoming more of what they can be and doing what they're wanting to do in a way that better supports all of life. Everybody wins. And you're not pushing anything, and you're not being naive and thinking that you can take a few people and have them go to an event and then go back in and change the system. We've had thousands and thousands of examples of how that doesn't work. So we're really wanting to go into a system, taking the working with those imaginal souls within the system who really have the aptitude and the passion to do this. And guess what? The process of creating the kind of future that we all want is extraordinarily satisfying. It's awesome. It's, and to be connected with other evolutionaries, other, the co-creative process can be as exciting and rewarding in the social realms as the procreation process can be in the physical realms. But we need to create a language for it. We need to create the space for that to happen.
Delicious. I mean, it's so radically obvious that this is what's needed in the world, and being around this conversation, and nobody's just known how to hold that space. So thank you for showing that shred of light and just kind of opening that space. And it's so powerful to see it as an organic space, as an intuitive space, as a wholehearted network that's just interconnected, interdependent, and all evolving together, because that's really what the true spirit of evolution is about.
An important thing is that in this work, it isn't organized around problems. Okay. So it's organized around developing the systemic capacity to learn and change.
Wow.
And
that's
so
a huge shift.
And so that takes, that's a larger kind of thing to get your head around. Because the idea of, well, we're going to solve the hunger problem or this problem or that problem, immediately you can move into action. It's very satisfying, whether it works or not, or whether it gets at the root cause or not. But this is different. What we're doing is growing the capacity to make root changes in our systems, because I'm convinced that the design of our systems is at the root of all those problems. And if you have our systems that are designed to be conscious and caring and self-evolving, we would not be having the problems that we're seeing. We'd have different kind of challenges, but there'd be more fun than starving.
For sure.